Also at this point, the Panasonic cassette machine decided to fuck up in earnest. Not only was Anne inaudible, but Zappa became progressively more garbled. Then Zappa says, her name was Shirley Anne. She used to sing in Sweden. I don't know whether she made records. Then Zappa talks to Ainsley Dunbar, who says that Shirley Anne is a very common name in Sweden. Zappa says, yeah, I'd like to find about six more like Shirley Anne. She was standing backstage talking with Jimmy Carr Black, who tried to get in her pants one time when we were in Sweden, and she wasn't going for it, you know, so he was hustling her. And when he wasn't meeting with too much success back there, he decided he would finally introduce her to the rest of the members of the group. So he said, quote, this is Shirley Anne, and she sings. So I said, sing. So she sang a couple of bars, and I said, would you go on stage with us? Then Frank says, we had to really con her into coming out there. She said, what'll I sing? I said, whatever you want. So she started off singing. She sang, I am made of fire and air. Come and touch me. And then Anne says, my father was the wind. Zappa says, she was making up this weird stuff, so Lowell George started singing duets with her. Motorhead was snorking. David says, what are some of the problems for writing for violin unamplified and Fender bass and making it sound decent? And David says in brackets, what we call a puny move to redirect the interview. Zappa says, the problems occur when you try and make it happen as an acoustical performance. You have to balance the volumes out, because if it's basically a recording project, we can control it. Turn a knob and they're at equal volume. David says, you don't have a problem writing in your style for either one. Zappa walks away and people are talking because Ainsley Dunbar is leaving. At this point, I'm getting desperate. I decide I must convince Zappa of my musical literacy. David says, I'd like to talk now about something that's hinted at on the freakout jacket. You listed a whole bunch of names of contemporary composers, avant-garde, jazz musicians, old R&B people. And Zappa says, and other people. That would be the other, all those high school buddies that we came across. So David says, and other people, whom we may or may not know. At this point, I was upset by the photographer who, trying to get a good angle, stepped on me and then the microphone. Well, what composers, says David? The only people I would add to it would be Penderecki, and that would be about it. I'd add Honegger, too. Why Honegger? I like his music. I like the way it sounds. I got about 3 albums by him last year. I listened to them over and over again for about 4 months. What particular works? The Liturgical Symphony, Symphony for Strings and 2 Trumpets, the Pastorale d'Ette, the Chant of Joy. I like that stuff. What about Penderecki? I like his instrumental music more than his choral music. The Violin Capriccioso I thought was a good piece. What's that violinist's name? Zappa and David in unison. Paul Zukofsky. Then David says, the Threnody for 52 string instruments for the victims of Hiroshima. Have you heard that? Zappa says, yeah, I have 2 different versions of that. Yeah, says David, the Victrola and the Philips. Frank says, I like the Victrola one better. Why? The sound is better. What about the composers on the Freakout album? Could you say why you like them or what elements of their music have come into yours? Zappa says, the only composers I like consistently, I like about 90% of what they write. The ones he likes, and he likes about 90% of what they write, are Perez, Stravinsky, and Webern. Just about everything they write, I enjoy, with lesser degree of enjoyment for Schoenberg and Berg. What do you like by Schoenberg? There's this septet for baritone voice, mandolin, guitar, clarinet, cello, violin. I like the orchestra pieces, the ones with, quote, summer morning by a lake, unquote. Oh, yeah, Opus 16, 5 pieces for orchestra. Zappa says, I like most of Bartok, too. David says, I thought so. How about some of the electronic composers you mentioned, like Cagle and Stockhausen? Zappa says, I'm not so impressed by Cagle's electronic music as I was by this lecture he gave at a college in California where he played a tape of a piece called Anagramma. Have you ever heard it? David says, no. Zappa says, I don't think it's released. I got the score to it. It's fantastic. It's for chorus and percussion. There's a harp in there and a few other things. I'm surprised they never put that out, but the orchestration was unbelievable. For instance, in the percussion section, there are 2 giant rolls of paper that these guys have to rip up on cue, and it's really notated out exactly. They have sheets of tinfoil that they play, and it really sounds good. And the chorus is singing phonetic texts. It's probably the basis of, and he names his own song on Freakout, It Can't Happen Here. So he's saying that Cagle piece influenced that Freakout performance. It Can't Happen Here. David says, I think you quote most from Verez and Stravinsky. Zappa says, you do? You do think that? Can you prove it? David goes, can I prove it? Well, I caught a few quotes from The Rite of Spring and The Firebird by Stravinsky. So he's talking about quoting musically from Verez and Stravinsky. Zappa says, can you prove it? Can I prove it? Well, I caught a few quotes from The Rite of Spring and The Firebird. Frank Zappa says, that's pretty obvious. Then David says, I saw you once on stage do part of Integral by Verez. Did you ever do that? Yeah, we did that with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, but we also used to play the opening oboe line from Octandra, another Verez piece. We used to play that all the time. Did Ian Underwood play that on the oboe? Nope, we played a screaming fuzz tone thing, sings it for me. Big crashes and gongs and shit. We used to throw that in the middle of regular rock and roll type stuff. We play something that sounds like a 1950s saxophone instrumental and then end it with Octandra. Davis is absolutely free is probably the first example of Sprechstimme in rock. Zappa says, that's incorrect. The first example of Sprechstimme in rock can be attributed to early blues singers. John Lee Hooker was doing it a long time ago. All the Delta performers half talked and half sung their words. David says, did that come from anywhere, that particular section? It sounded like Schoenberg or Webern. Where you were, the reciter. Did that come from anywhere, the particular section where you were the reciter? Was that you? Zappa goes, she tickled his fancy all night long, quoting from the album. David, I'm not sure about this, but I think I heard a little bit of Satie. Could that be possible? Or Satie, could that be possible? Zappa says, there's no overt quotes from Satie in any of the music. Not like taking the lullaby from the Firebird and playing simultaneously against another background from the Rite of Spring, like we did in the Duke of Prunes. Duke of Prunes in quotes. How have you approached the quote? Have you tried to be as gross as possible sometimes? Zappa says, sure. As an example, to give you an idea of the intellectual capabilities of the people who review this music, I've been accused of quotes from Boris Godunov, a fantastic array of composers I've never even listened to, let alone would rip off any of their music and stick it in there. But just by playing part of a Stravinsky number, one of those songs, and doing an interview saying to a guy, yeah, there's a Stravinsky thing in there, then the word Stravinsky appears in an article someplace. And the kids who've never even heard of Stravinsky might say, quote, wow, I wonder what the rest of his stuff sounds like, unquote. The same with Verez. So in a way, I've accomplished a certain broadening of musical horizons for a small number of people. David says, aren't you also accustoming people to the music by playing it on stage? Zappa says, hardly, not by the way we do it. They wouldn't even recognize it in most cases if they heard the original. After hearing the same riff over and over, they might say, hey. Zappa says, you really think they have that kind of retention? Dave, if they hear Absolutely Free a number of times and they hear Survivor from Warsaw by Schoenberg, they might say, hey, that sounds like Frank Zappa. Zappa laughs. Yeah, well, I doubt that many of the kids who listen to Absolutely Free are going to listen to Survivor from Warsaw. Okay, says David, how about some of the jazz people you mentioned? I think you mentioned Cecil Taylor, Ornette Coleman. I heard their records in high school. Then Zappa talks to someone else. Then he comes back and says, I like Eric Dolphy, too. What particularly did you like by Dolphy? An album called Blues and the Abstract Truth. David says, Oliver Nelson. Zappa has gotten up to answer the phone. After he comes back, he starts talking to Mark about the Fillmore. David, we were discussing Eric Dolphy. Zappa says, you heard the album Iron Man? David, yeah. Zappa says, that's the other one I like. Well, how about blues and R&B of the 50s? You must have liked Accelo Records. I noticed you mentioned Lightning Slim and Slim Harpo. Zappa says, sure, they were hard to get to. Where are you from, by the way? Zappa says, I was born in Baltimore and raised in California, in the desert, in a town called Lancaster. Well, he was raised many places in California. How big was it? About 100,000 population, but it was spread out over maybe 200 square miles. Did you live on a farm? No, I lived on a tract of little stucco houses, Okies with cars dying in their yards. You know how you always have to pull up a Chevrolet and let it croak on your lawn? Did you go to high school there? Did you find out about R&B in high school? I found out about R&B in junior high school. Where did you find it? One day I was listening to the radio and I heard this record come on. It was called G. David says the crows. Yeah, says Zappa. And then I by the Velvets. And I said, that's it. Was there music in your house that you heard? Zappa says, we didn't even have a record player. What was the first music you ever heard? Oh, I had heard background music to soap operas. That was it, though. Swing bands on the radio. When did you first hear jazz and contemporary music? The thing that led me to Varese's music was an article in Look magazine saying how great Sam Goody's record store was. Sam Goody sells records so well that he can even sell a record called Ionizations. They even called the album wrong. It was the complete works of Edgar Varese, Volume 1. And they were telling how ugly this record sounded. It was just drums and sirens, and nobody would want to own this record, and Sam Goody was actually selling it. Was this the one on Columbia? Zappa says, the first album was recorded in 1950. He didn't get anything out in Columbia for another 10 years. This album was EMS, which stands for Elaine Music Stores, number 401. It had a gray cover. They had two different covers out on it. One was gray with a big portrait. One was black and white. The whole thing was conducted by Waldman. David says, Frederick Waldman. Zappa says, yeah, Frederick Waldman, under the supervision of the composer. And the album notes were by Finkelstein. That was the first album I owned, period, but it was the first record of any kind of music other than rhythm blues that I was interested in. It took me almost a year to find that record after I saw that article, and I found it in a store, and the guy wanted $6 for it. And I said, $6 for a record? He said, how much money you got? So I gave him $2 and went away. I had this little record player this big with these little wrought iron legs which made it stand off the table like that and a speaker on the bottom that blew into the table. You put a quarter on the tone arm and that's what I used to play that album on over and over again. My parents forbade me to play it in their presence because the sirens made my mother neurotic while she was ironing. Mark Volman comes in and says, our first records run so close together. Yours was Varese and mine was Jan and Arnie. At this point, the tape becomes totally inaudible for the next 10 minutes. When we join our heroes again, Zappa is talking about his early experiences with recording studios. Zappa says, then we went down to see Dootsie Williams' place at Dootone Records. We actually stepped into the room where Earth Angel was recorded. It was like going to heaven. There was a piano that appeared to have shriveled from overuse, a little stumpy piano, the cheapest they could get, the only thing that would fit into that room. And there was enough room to have that piano, maybe five guys standing up around a microphone, maybe an upright bass, maybe one guy hitting a snare drum in the corner. That was about it. I'm sure most of their group, vocal masters were done in that little room. In the 50s, a lot of the things were to disc, but the way they did this recording was they had a master disc, and then they do four or five cuts on the master disc. They'd have like six versions of the same song on a big disc. They chose the one they liked and then played that onto another disc, which became the single master. It was really crude. So then the writer, David, says, after this interlude of audibility, Zappa, David, Mark, and Ann fade into oblivion, and nothing, not even equalization, could save them. It was, alas, the best part of the interview, where Zappa talked about being a high school hood with Don Van Vliet, early recording sessions and groups with Ray Collins, meeting Johnny Otis, what he thinks about being misinterpreted as advocating drugs, his guitar playing, guitars, electronic gadgets. Too bad, but fate was cruel to me that day. I hope I get a chance to talk to Frank again someday under better circumstances. I like to talk about his high school days and before at great length, where it seems to be the key to much of his imagery, lyrical and musical. I hope I won't be as paralyzed by fear so that I can tell Frank why I didn't like Prelude to the Afternoon with Sexually Aroused Gas Mask, because I still don't like that piece. After all, nobody's perfect, not even one of the geniuses of contemporary music. So that guy was pretty knowledgeable, wouldn't you say? He knew all the characters that Frank mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you with me? Are you here?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, Oxy.
I'm here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to say that...
Go ahead. No, I'm going to play the song that he didn't like, Prelude to the Okay. We'll do that in a minute, but yeah, go ahead.
I'm noting as you're reading this that the interviewer is very self-conscious, but that Frank tends to have that effect on people that he interacts with.
Yeah.
But, you know, Frank just seems... There's this persona that's created by these articles and the media, basically, that without interacting with him, just makes him seem like this, you know, overly critical, serious,
yeah,
not very, you know, not very good-humored artist who's, you know, struggling with his own whatever it is, you know, unexpressed creations or...
Right.
And if he weren't, you know, if this guy interviewing him wasn't, you know, deferent because of his celebrity status, it just makes you wonder if, what Frank would be doing or where he'd be or who he'd be hanging out with, you know.
If Frank was not a musician?
Right, if he wasn't, you know, a celebrity or creative, it's the persona, at least, that's created makes it seem like he'd be just a difficult person to get to know or get along with.
Well, he wasn't that way when I interacted with him. He was a nice guy. It's just that, remember, he's a huge genius, and he has to play for 10-year-olds.
Right.
He's got these idiotic interviewers. he doesn't have a good image. I mean, Rolling Stone, he said, smeared him in 68. Now, this is like 3 years later. He's not happy with the media coverage, probably. He doesn't give a fuck on some level, so he doesn't make any attempts to be nice. But occasionally there are good interviews where he is nice, and then the people get along. But the guy is totally distracted. It's like he had to eat. So if you remind him he had to eat, he'd get pissed off at you because he was so into making stuff with his ears that any other thing that came along would interrupt him and bug him, it seems.
Right, it was unnecessary.
Especially when he's running a tour. Yeah, I mean, this guy had to do everything. He had to organize. He's like a hands-on manager, which may be a fault, but who's going to handle all the problems that are going to come up? Because he's got union people that don't even like him. Unions fuck up his stuff, you know. So, yeah, he caused a lot of headaches, I guess. I don't know if you could say he could be nicer or something.
Not necessarily.
Plowed on.
I'm just saying. I'm just saying that the persona.
Through,
spot on true, you said?
Plowed on. He plowed on through.
Plowed on through. Okay. Yeah, he said his frustration also was just dealing with band members that had to have, you know, bring family along and had to take care of that whole sort of logistical nightmare. But I got that. I was just noting
I never saw that. Wait. Bart, I never heard of that. What? He complained about musicians bringing their families? Where is that?
Yes. That was when he was talking about how the struggle that touring was part of it, was having to manage crew members who felt like they had to take their family with them and a whole bunch of other incidental sort of luggage and belongings or something to that effect. He was just saying...
Where is that said, Bert?
Same interview.
Okay. Bart. Yeah, I recall that. It's when he was talking about the benefits of electronic instruments, like moving to the synthetic instruments and producing
the
studio.
If you find that, send that to me. I've never heard that interview, so it doesn't sound familiar. So if you can never find it.
Okay.
So there's this magazine, Jazz and Pop, and they get some illustrator to do pictures of Paul McCartney, Frank Zappa, Jim Morrison, Leon Thomas, he's a guy who sings with Pharoah Sanders, and John and Yoko 30 years later, so that'd be 2001. So they have a little poem. So they have a picture of Paul McCartney. It says, "Wasn't it heartening when Mr. McCartney put aside favorites and subpoenaed all? 3 decades after, quote, an ego trip's not so good. I'll be starting another group and calling it Paul." So that's the satire on him. So they have a picture of Zappa as Colonel Sanders. Remember, Colonel Sanders is the little puppet inside the glove compartment of the Volkswagen bus that runs the global concentration camp. So they have a picture of Frank. I don't know if they knew that. No, they could have known that. This is a couple years later. So they have Frank as an old Colonel Sanders running to deliver something, a steaming something. Doesn't look too appetizing. So the poem is, Frank Zappa is quite a smart cookie. His talents seem almost spooky, way ahead of his time. He passes off slime as Colonel Zappa's southern fried nookie. Way ahead of his time. So they're saying he makes slime as Colonel Zappa's southern fried nookie. So that's pretty mean, eh? Always getting insulted
he's
by the little
He's just speaking
people.
Technically. It's not mean.
That's right. And he said in some interview around 1980, he says, I'm a genius. Just don't hold it against me.
Ooh.
People and Ian says the same thing. If you start standing out, little people will hate you.
Don't hate me because I'm beautiful.
Hey, look. What?
Don't hate me because I'm beautiful.
Bert.
What's that?
Right. That's what I say. I say.
Seneca, the Roman philosopher, he said, if you don't want to be criticized, don't speak, don't do anything.
If you don't want to be treated what? Badly? What's the word?
Criticized.
Don't speak, don't do anything. Because it doesn't matter if you are good or bad.
Yeah, but what's...
Just if you speak or do anything, people is going to criticize you.
What? Right, but what is the opening words you say?
Seneca said.
Oh, Seneca said that. Okay.
Don't speak.
Seneca.
Don't do anything.
How the fuck do you know about Seneca? That's outrageous. Seneca has talked about my McLuhan occasionally. What do you know about him? How can someone from,
I finally read
from
a book
from the,
about
the most dangerous... You have a book. I read a book once. How could a person who grew up in the concentration fearful camp of Mexico City know about, have the time to learn about Seneca? That's quite remarkable, Roxy. Oh, you moved to Berlin. That's what happened. You moved to Berlin and then you had time to read shit, right?
Lucius Aeneas Seneca,
no.
Also known as Seneca the Younger.
Yes, Seneca... Didn't he work for Nero or somebody?
Was he pro?
He was a tutor and advisor to Emperor Nero.
Well, he had to...
Yeah, the guy who burned down Rome or something.
What's that, Roxy?
What about the poet?
That was her family, actually.
You need to speak. I don't know, Roxy. You're blipping in and out.
He was condemned to...
Oh, they killed him?
He had to drink the cicuta, the poison. Yeah, he was...
Wow.
He criticized the system, and he was condemned to drink the poison.
And he did.
For his alleged complicity in the Pisonian conspiracy to assassinate Nero.
Hmm. And he was killed. He died, right? You assume he died?
He was forced to commit suicide.
Forced to commit suicide. Yeah, I knew he had something bad about his scene. Okay, there's this art. Remember I read the Playboy article last week about Frank and Zubin Mehta when they played with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Remember that? So here's a letter. Yeah. There's a guy, Miklos, this is in Playboy, Miklos Roza from Los Angeles, California. He's a prolific composer of film scores whose credits include Ben-Hur, Quo Vadis, and El Cid. So those would be those late 50s, early 60s movies. So this is an old guy, Miklos Roza. So he says, I found the F.P. Tullius article, Zubin and the Mothers, about the head-on collision of two musical worlds, Frank Zappa's Mothers of Invention rock group performing with Zubin Mehta and the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Most amusing. So he found this most amusing. For the future, I recommend go head on, Frank. Go head on, Zubin, but never together. So they got, he's a typical guy, got thrown by apparent conflict. We listened to it, we went through it, it wasn't that bad, right? Maybe the article exaggerates the conflict too much.
No.
So he's telling Frank to go ahead. What?
What we listened to was fine. Yes.
Everybody tries to be real polite. You wait, then you give.
There was a lot of rhythm.
For each other.
The acoustics of the hall were terrible. There was a lot of reverb.
Reverb, right, right.
The acoustics of the hall were terrible. But everybody was having fun.
Yeah, the audience had fun. So there's a famous guy, Yehudi Menuhin. You ever heard of him? Everybody's heard of Yehudi Menuhin. He writes a letter from London, England. So I don't know if he was there, but he says...
I think.
Beg your pardon?
Violinist, I think.
Oh, okay. So he says...
He was a violinist.
That's the problem. I didn't ask you to repeat yourself. What do we do, Bert? We get Roxy to phone in again? It's just...
It might be a delay.
It's a delay. I mean, you have someone in Hawaii, someone in Germany, someone in Sweden, and someone in Texas.
Switzerland,
sorry.
Well,
yeah, but Skype is really
weird
today, Bob. Skype is really weird today.
Okay.
The rock against the Philharmonic.
Roxy, I don't know how much more we're going to do, but you could hang up and I could call you. That'll make you clear. And we want you to be clear. You always have something useful to say. So you could stay, you could keep your Skype on and just answer your phone, right? You're not talking through your phone.
Okay.
All right.
Hello.
Here we go. Okay, I'm going to flip over.
So, Yehudi Menuhin, Yehudi, last name Menuhin, was an American-born violinist and conductor who spent most of his performing career in Britain. He is widely considered one of the greatest violinists of the 20th century. Born April 22, 1916, died March 12, 1999, Berlin, Germany. He was born in New York City.
Okay. Bert, she answered by saying, Public Council of 11, with a snotty tone.
Get the snot
Public
out.
Council of 11? Right. Okay, so she's clear. So here's what Yehudi Menuhin says. I suspect it to be an indication of my middle age that I find F.P. Toulouse's description of the Zubin and the Mothers Run Contra tiresome. The exposition of so much noisy egotism is an indication of the mental age that Zappa is so very lucratively exploiting. The exposition of so much noisy egotism is an indication of the mental age, M-E-N-T-A-L, mental age that Zappa is so very lucratively exploiting. To shock the complacent, to shake up the conformist, to rattle those of constipated mind is and always has been the duty of every intelligent creature and every truly creative artist. But it is a sad indictment of our times that screaming and obscenity are the only means left to effect change. Even more distasteful is the financial profiteering that is part of the whole symbiosis. He means media ecology, I guess, by symbiosis. If these neo-prophets donated one-third of their appearance fee to the sad and needy, perhaps even to those establishment symphony orchestras such as Zubin Mehta's, then one would feel better able to accept them as a part of society. I congratulate Tullius on his graphic and lively description of the encounter between the classic orchestra and Zappa's group. Zappa is obviously a very talented man. A pity he sees fit to blast his ideas through a cannon at huge regiments. A pity he sees fit to blast his ideas through a cannon at huge regiments. So they all begrudgingly say he's a talented guy, but then they make their little snarky statement. And if I'm not mistaken, Zappa's mistress, Nancy Lennon, her husband through the 70s and 80s, was Yehudi Menuhin's cousin. So there is Yehudi Menuhin. So this is 1971 when Nancy Lennon hooks up with Zappa. Yehudi doesn't know that Zappa is going to be connected to Nancy through Yehudi's cousin. I could find Lionel's name was, find Lionel's book. He wrote something. He was an L.A. poet.
Yehudi Menuhin, or How I Met Frank Zappa.
Is that tonight? Is that what's on Amazon or someplace? You're reading that?
There's something on, yeah, Fat Man on the Left, Four Decades in the Underground.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like the title, yeah, that's what he did. He wrote about his life with Frank.
I'll read
and all that.
They're showing you can take a peek at the books. I'll read a little.
Okay.
So when I returned to Los Angeles, and the author of this book is
Lionel something.
Lionel Rolfe.
Yes.
So it says, when I returned to Los Angeles, I did not forget what happened in London. A couple of years of intensive investigation followed during which I wrote a book. Yet the mystery remains. I never really found adequate answers. What is the source of great genius like that displayed in the Menuhin family line? What psychological factors foster an entire brood of genius children? Or is genius purely genetic or prearranged by fate or a miracle? There are no easy answers. I read everything I could find on prodigies in the psychological literature, which was surprisingly little. It was during this time I met Nige, my future wife. She was cold, tired, and hungry the first time we got together. She was 19 and I had just turned 30 and was living a relatively wild bachelor life in Hollywood. I had broken up with Diana, my first wife, and mother of my children, Heather and Hala. Nige had no permanent place to live and was sleeping on a friend's couch. A short time before, she had been living in the basement of Frank Zappa's house on Woodrow Wilson Drive in Laurel Canyon, where she'd been a secret lover as well as a guest. But Nige and Zappa also had an intense musical relationship. She watched the great musical cynic cry as he played her some Bartok, for example. After a while, Frank's wife got upset. She knew he was not faithful to her, but she didn't appreciate it being thrown in her face. So Zappa prevailed on Ruth and Ian Underwood, musicians in his band, to put her up. Ruth was Nige's closest friend at the time, anyway. Nige had also played guitar and sang in the band, so she was welcome to sleep on Ruth and Ian's couch. Years later, when Ruth and Ian were splitting up, Ruth came and lived with us. Let's see if I can find some more. I was ashamed of being so enchanted with a 19-year-old woman, but Nige was different. She was so precocious, so bright, so interesting to talk with, so much fun, I easily forgot that she was more than 10 years younger. I didn't feel that much difference between us at all. Mentally, she seemed to be a wise old woman, and physically, she was a young woman with great sexual appetites. There was a rub, of course. She was still madly in love with Zappa and would sometimes sneak away to see him. Oddly enough, Zappa approved of Nige and me and seemed to like me quite a bit. We argued about music. He was impressed by who my uncle was because Zappa wanted approval from the old European school, desperately, even if he constantly belittled the tradition. Should I keep going? There's more. I asked him what he would do with his electric instruments if the power went out. Turn on the generators, he smirked. I was trying to make a point about the primacy of acoustic instruments, but it was ignored, both by Zappa and Nige. Sometimes Nige's parroting of Zappa's musical views irritated me a lot. Perhaps my feeling was influenced by the thought that she still made love to him from time to time. But I, too, had come from the wild 60s, full of bohemian bacchanals and orgies. I liked the show of pulchritude that was around Zappa, so much the hallmark of rock and roll mythology. we got together, I'm sure that Naiji was also impressed with my being related to Yehudi Menuhin. In the 60s, Yehudi made a series of records with sitarist Ravi Shankar called East Meets West, and they were very popular. Naiji had studied with Shankar, but she also was hostile, since to her, the Menuhins represented the European. Classical music was the most unpardonable of things to her, snobby and unabashedly romantic. Naiji had a reputation of being kind of a wild woman. Once her father took me aside and warned me that she wouldn't stay with me. She never stays with anyone, gets bored too quickly, she'll move on, he said. Several months later, he took me inside and admitted that I seemed to be the first man she was serious about. He said it sort of with a smirk that said he couldn't see what she saw in me. Another person, a journalist, who knew her as part of the Zappa circle and knew the wild stories of Naiji at some of Zappa's after-concert orgies, offered her view of the apparent contradiction. At times, Naiji had acted like the most wanton party girl, she said, but she also noted that Naiji was one of the most intelligent and talented women she had ever met and could plunge into a deep conversation about philosophy at any moment. She also saw her perform on stage with Zappa at Carnegie Hall. Yes, I knew of the discrepancies, and they made her seem wild and crazy and erotic beyond belief. After the first trip to London, I had reason to become jealous of Zappa because she would still see him. I was jealous of him, but I also genuinely could not see why people regarded him as a genius. Interesting and talented, perhaps. I thought Zappa's childhood friend, Captain Beefheart, was more of an authentic genius. One night, shortly after we started living together, Naiji said she wanted to go and make dirty love to Captain Beefheart. Ever the 60s bohemian, I said, sure. I liked Beefheart. At that time, it didn't make me feel bad to think of her making love to him. People making love to others seemed the natural way to do things back in those still 60s influence days. She came back that night and told me all about her session with Beefheart, and then we made wild love.
Ooh-wee.
So I'm skipping down in this book where there are passages mentioning Zappa.
Is she implying that she had made love with Beefheart?
No, she's actually stating that pretty explicitly.
Okay, listen to this. I'll tell you my involvement with her. Of course, I fucked her, you know, here to heaven and back, of course. I was not going to miss out on all this shit. But anyways.
Before Beefheart or after Beefheart?
I got her when she was 69 years old, so a little later. No, so I want to say this. So I think it's online somewheres. I wonder if it's even available. So I did a long dialogue with her in 1995, say, 95, 96, through Jerry Fialka at Jerry Fialka's place in Venice. And it's a very good long discussion. I mean, she knew a lot, I knew a lot, and it's good. Then we played her, me talking to Zappa, and I've told the story many times, but just that now you're hearing more about her, you might appreciate this a little more. So she's the only person in the world who's heard the audio of me talking to Zappa through the Evergreens. So she heard it, and do you know what she said at the end? Do you remember me telling this story before?
I can't remember.
She said, that must be Frank. He said the right, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which I think is singular, he said it with an S, the Rites of Spring. And he said it that way through the Evergreens, and she said he always said it wrong. So here was the spirit still saying it wrong, the Rites of Spring, if that's the wrong way. Whichever one way, singular plural is the wrong way. So she was quite impressed with the fact that the spirit was saying the Rites of Spring erroneously, in reference to Stravinsky. She also said
singular.
That was Zappa's personality. What?
It's singular.
Yeah, so Zappa said it with the S.
Yeah.
And she also said that was Zappa's personality. She could hear Zappa's personality in there. And so the one person who heard it was the right person to play it because she kind of validated it. So that was nice. And maybe it's the transcript might be on fivebody.com. Wherever the transcript is, Jerry wrote the little intro where, or maybe we both did, where we point out that she, we write these two points that sound like it's personality and that the right to spring. So, so that was good. And then what happened next? A couple of years. So I met Lionel, her husband, and many years later they did split, and she ended up with some guy, musician, on Long Island in New York City. But back when she was still with Lionel, and she also gave me copies. She did a book on Pierre, the, Alfred Jarry, J-A-R-R-Y. Do you know him, Roxy? The playwright in late 19th century in France, who did Père Ubu, Ubu the king, King Ubu or whatever. So she did a book on Alfred Jarry, and one guy made a big deal, one guy in our Finnings Wake group made a big deal how Joyce was very influenced by Alfred Jarry and pointed out all the references to Alfred Jarry in Finnings Wake. And then I asked Joyce through the Evergreens if was there a lot of Alfred Jarry? Was Jarry important? And he said, well, he was one of the many things I threw into the soup of Finnegan's Wake. So she did a book on Alfred Jarry and maybe another book. And Lionel, this guy we're reading, he did a book on the poetry scene of L.A. in the 40s, 50s, or 60s or something. So so Nige gave me those books, and she also gave a book to Carolyn to see some kind of rough version of something to get it published in New York. And I don't think Carolyn made much of an effort to get it published. She was too busy or she just didn't feel motivated. So that was the last involvement with 9G for many years. And then I talked to her on the phone, I don't know, around 2000, and she was not too keen on talking about Zappa. I guess it was she was sick of talking about Zappa. So that was my last encounter. And you probably can go on YouTube, since they have footage of many of the musicians who play at the Zappanale in East Germany, in Bad Doberan, that I went to in 2011. And you could probably see, I've seen there's a YouTube of Nige playing there with her band or a band. But that's the story of Nige Lennon.
So
and her book is called Being Frank. Being Frank. It's a good book. She has a lot to say, interesting things to say about Zappa. Of course, Gail didn't like the book.
So Nige was Yehudi's niece.
No, Lionel was.
Lionel was Yehudi's nephew.
Yeah. I don't think Nige was related to Yehudi Menuhin. I think Lionel okay. was. Is that right? Well, Lionel was more of a sophisticated. Nige was a working class girl. You know, she wouldn't have been related to a family of geniuses that Lionel would have. And
okay, right, yep.
He's talking. He doesn't seem to know that Yehudi commented on Frank, you know, in Playboy magazine.
Right. So, aside
okay, well,
from
that's
that,
good. Can you send me the titles? There are two books, eh?
Well, it was one book. I think that might have been the title of the first chapter. The book is called Fat Man on the Left, Four Decades in the Underground.
Right. Now, what's interesting, one surprising thing about Nige was when I met her in 95, you know, my play, Who's Forgotten Furry Lint, the radio play, you could say, was based on Larry Flint and Zappa and Mae Brussel and Larry Flint trying to expose everything and trying to create an alternative Time magazine called The Rebel. And while he was running that, he got put in a mental asylum in Chicago or someplace. And then Hustler seemed to be taken over by other people. So there was this pretty interesting conspiracy battle going on at Hustler magazine in 83-84. And Zappa and Mae Brussel were in the middle of it. Well, when I met Nygie, somehow it came up, and she said she was an editor. Her and Lionel worked on the Rebel magazine. They actually worked. So that would be what Lionel means, 40 years in the underground. Definitely Larry Flint's Rebel was an underground magazine. I mean, the authorities stopped it after about 10 issues. I've got all the issues. Didn't last long. Got sabotaged. But Nygie was there. Worked for Larry Flint. That was a coincidence in my life.
I'm sure that the Yehudi was impressed. Yeah.
So I did Who's Forgotten Fairy Lind. I think I wrote it out in 84. We played it on the radio, me and Dave Neufeld in 88. Then I meet her 7 years later, and she was had worked on the legendary Rebel magazine. The Rebel, I think it was called. Okay, so let me play you Prelude to the Afternoon of a Sexually Aroused Gas Mask. which is on an album called Weasels Rip My Flesh in 1970. 3 minutes and 48 seconds long, and who didn't? David, this guy who said, I dreamed I interviewed Zappa in my maiden form bra. Okay, so is everything going here? that sounded pretty good.
Yeah, right. I would
it
say
actually.
Yeah.
The opening noises reminded me of Roxy's voice. Something about, I don't know what it was. It sounded like what Roxy would sound like if she had to do that.
And people without an ear for music might not recognize the Stravinsky in that opening section either.
Is that right? Is that where it is?
Obviously, obvious Stravinsky influence there, yes. And Roxy influence.
Okay. Yeah, they talk about different places where Stravinsky shows up, but I don't hear it there. Is it like the very first part? If I go like this. Is that what you're talking about? Is that Stravinsky?
Probably the part where Roxy was sort of screaming Yoko Ono style in the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, I was kind of being facetious.
Is that Stravinsky?
Well, it's good to hear it again.
Oh.
No. I'm being facetious.
No, Stravinsky. Okay. But I'm sure. Right there.
That does sound kind of like Roxy.
That's Roxy. That does sound like Roxy. Somehow she's done that. We've heard her do something like that. That's right. Yep, there it is, Roxy. Been validated. Then it went into Project X, which is a nice song, but I didn't want to go through that, so I stopped it. So are we all happy with
my interpretation?
Just a sec. What did you say about interpretation?
Yes, you said, are we happy with my interpretation
yes.
of the aroused gas mask?
Yeah, we are. Very happy. Okay, so do we dare bring Kyle in to comment? What do you think? You want to hear a comment from Kyle, or do we have other things? Oh, I know what I want to do. There's this cartoon that was done, you know, back in the early 70s. I never read it. So it's put up on National Lampoon Comics. That was a famous magazine back then. Wait, is that Bert? Bert, have we excluded you? Are you back in, Bert?
Yes.
Yes, you right.
Yeah, I'm back
in now.
Anything
you wanted to say?
Was that tune? Yes, was that tune done by the Synclavier? Or is it just the band itself?
No.
Does it sound like...
This is you know, 10-15 years before the Synclavier. 1970.
Okay.
1969.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So that's all you wanted to say, right? Did we miss out?
Yes.
Did we screw it up by having you out? Should you have been part of it? Did you have something to say?
No.
You've been here?
Okay. I've been, but that's okay.
Yeah, do you remember National Lampoon magazine?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So, looks like about 1970, I've got this in my 1969-70 folder, they did a comic book, National Lampoon Comics. It's called College Concert Cut-Ups by Mikhail Choquette. So it has a big poster. It looks like Archie comics. You know Archie? Remember Archie and Veronica and Betty and Jughead? It seems to be sort of in that style. It says, in person, one night only, Frank Zappa, Saturday, November 13th. And so they have a high school teenage girl goes, is he the one who exposed himself in Miami? That would be Jim Morrison. Then this guy goes, gosh, Sally, I'm not sure. So I guess that's a joke that Zappa's being misidentified with Jim Morrison. So then, and it says other names are Joe Orlando, Henry Scarpelli, and P. Bramley. They get some kind of credits. So then you go to the comic, the story, and it says, days in advance, the homecoming committee makes careful plans. So a guy with a pipe, so maybe he's the, maybe these are teachers? Guy with a pipe, maybe a few
the students, homecoming committee.
Faculty and students.
Yeah.
Right, so it might it probably has some faculty and some students. So it says, all right, we've got to make up our minds. Is it one famous act or two semi-famous acts? So the older guy says with the pipe, what about Simon and Garfunkel? Another guy says, the Brothers Four were good last year. They were even better the year before. Then this kid who's looking at Playboy with nude images says, I want to be MC. And this other woman, young teenager, says, no, let Rick do it. He can really crack jokes. And some guy in the back says, with sunglasses and a hippie bead, says, hey, listen, my cousin knows one of the guys from the Moby Grape. And then another guy goes, there's no the. You know, when he says, from the Moby Grape, he says, there's no the. And the hippie guy goes, there's no what? It's just Moby Grape. So then this other teen girl says, how much do you think it would cost to bring the Beatles back together? And there's a poster of the dog in...
Oh, yeah.
There's a poster with the dog in Peanuts. You know that dog's always lying
Snoopy.
On the doghouse. That's in the background.
Snoopy.
Snoopy?
Yeah, Snoopy. Okay, so they're going, the Brothers Four were good last year, and this girl says they were even better the year before, so they keep having the Brothers Four. Okay, so then...
So you're reading, I'm following along, you're actually reading comic book pages.
How are you seeing that? Where do you find that?
It's a AFKNET.
You're Google? Oh,
Google.
This would be the Zappa archive. They even have this. It's incredible
yes.
what they have at that archive. That's pretty good. So the next page, it says, finally, after much preparation, the big day arrives. And these two teenagers are saying, gee, do you think we miss them? The other guy says, you stay here. I'll have them paged. So you actually see in the drawing, you see the mothers coming through. But this couple, they don't think these guys are the musicians, I guess. So they're trying to figure out who are the musicians. And then this guy says, do you have any baggies, Mr. Zappa? Did you all get to sit together on the plane? And Zappa's looking a little disturbed. So I don't know why they said they probably missed him, because they do. What's all that noise? Ooh, man. Don't move. Is that you, Bert, moving? Scraped.
Yes, sorry.
All right. Okay. Yeah, don't move. So I don't know why they... I don't know if I'm right to say they don't recognize the mothers, because they do. So then it says 2.5 hours later, now they have a picture of the Volkswagen with the feet sticking out the window. That's actually the picture of a car on the 1971 album, Just Another Band from L.A. It has the mothers all crammed in the car and somebody's feet sticking out the window. Well, this little Volkswagen has his feet out like that. 2.5 hours later, I guess one of the kids says, officially the campus begins here. Now, they're just looking at farmland. But this is mostly the School of Agriculture. Wait till you see the new library, though. Have you ever played at a college before? Then another teenager says, actually, our school is pretty liberal, except for the jocks and some fraternity guys. And another teenager, one of the English teachers says he smokes pot. Whatever you do, Mr. Zappa, don't eat in the cafeteria because the food is really terrible. So then they get to the Holiday Inn, and the high school student guy says, we booked you in here because we figured you wouldn't go for Howard Johnson's Motor Lodge. And it says, Holiday Inn, welcome Pawnee City JCs. Later at the gym, they're looking at the poster, and the teenager saying, the posters came out really great, except the date is wrong. Then the girl says, but it doesn't really matter. Not too many people are coming anyway. They're all tired from last night's hayride. So Frank just remains silent. He's not saying anything, but he's kind of frowning. So then, now they're on stage, and it looks like they're setting up, they're doing the afternoon sound check or something, and the kids are setting up props. So somebody says, is that any better? Zappa says, great, the hum and the feedback balance perfectly. Then somebody says, hold it, everybody, please hold it. Then a cop says, get a letter from the dean and I'll unlock the fuse box for you. Get a letter from the dean and I'll unlock the fuse box for you. I think he's saying that to the mother's guy or maybe the roadie. Then the hippie guy says, I'm sorry, but some dude, foppish-looking guy, says, I'm sorry, but I can't change the lights now. They're all set up for the beauty pageant tomorrow. You'll have to work with, quote, surprise pink, unquote. So then this girl says, we're sending out to the New Athens for pizza. It's just as good as in Chicago or anywhere. Somebody says, no anchovies. Someone else says, no anchovies. And then somebody says, you mean all the outlets are direct current? Then a girl saying to one of the musicians, what do you mean chairs? Aren't we going to dance? Then some other guy, looks like a teacher, says, Why do I have to do everything? Let's get organized, guys. Boy, what an immature committee. Okay. Room.
From the Bob Dean.
and then there's a sign, go team, pulverize Peoria. Peoria is in Illinois, I think. So then the student guy says, gee, Mr. Zappa, I'm sorry. I just can't get any cooperation around here. And then some girl asked the Frank and some musicians, what do you want on your pizza? Zappa says, no mayonnaise. Then somebody comes running in saying, you're on. And then the cop is saying to someone else, get a letter from the dean and I'll unlock the soap. So then the MC is saying, and now getting on top of things, as Liberace said to Tiny Tim, let's have a big hand for a really way out group, Fred Zappa and the Mothers. Fred Zappa. So then this guy says, who introduced him as Fred Zappa, says, don't forget the sorority slave auction in the union tomorrow. And if anyone still hasn't ordered copies of the swimming team photographs, speak to Harvey Klein before Monday. I also have a few announcements to make about tickets for the Samuel Beckett Festival before I talk about next week's blood drive. Ooh, there's the blood theme. So then the next panel shows Zappa performing, and he's singing, Plastic People, You're Such a Drag. So in the audience you see quotes, they're better on records. Boy, he's really putting down the squares. Hey, this isn't the Brothers Four. They're better live than on records. Have they ever had a hit record? Someone else says, it's all a put on. Someone yells, go man, go. Someone else goes, wow, what a beat. Then someone says, why do they have to play so loud? Then you have some jock putting his arm around a young girl and saying, what are you doing after? Then it says, later, after the concert, two students or committee members are fighting. Hey, I'm the one who gives him the check. The other guy says, oh, come on, you've been with him all day. So then, next page, the cop who won't unlock anything, he says to himself, he's thinking, would it be too square to ask for an autograph for my kids? Then Zappa's sitting there talking to the students in the locker room, they're eating pizza and looking at them, and this woman says, "Hey, the pizza's cold." Then this woman asks, like the school newspaper journalist says, "What do you think of the government?" And Frank says, "I think they're trying to take over the country." And then another student journalist, "Hey, maybe you could write a piece for the Crimson Crier. I'll ask the editor, but I'm sure it's okay." Then another kid says, "Just don't make it too long or use dirty words. Not that we care." And then some guy's singing, 900 miles, 900 miles, you're 900 miles from your home. Then 800 miles, 800 miles. So it shows the different mothers talking to different students. But then it shows three mothers in the showers with people sneaking, creeping over above them and taking pictures of them naked in the shower. So one of the mothers says, "Did the pizza ever get here?" And then outside, one of the students is saying, "Let's all go to the Jolly Coachman." And there's someone actually filming the mothers showering naked in the washroom. Some other students are asking somebody, and they said, "Did you ever take lessons?" Shortly, we go on to the next page. Somebody says, "How late do bars stay open in New York, Mr. Zappa?" Then the student, the self-conscious committee member, says, "This isn't much," as they enter a bar. "This isn't much compared to the places you guys go to." Then you see some old men, and they're saying, "Look, look, Tiny Tim, ha, ha, ha." They think Zappa is Tiny Tim. He actually has similar hair. And there's some guy broadcasting. He's saying, "It's 11 o'clock, and we end another day of regular broadcasting." So the girl says, looking at these mean older guys, says, "Why don't we go straight to the party?" And then, and the sign on the bar wall, it says, "In God we trust. All others pay cash." That's one. That's something that Ion says. "In God we trust. All others pay cash." Another one, another sign says, "Beautify America. Get a haircut." So now they're at the party, and things start to swim, they say. At the party, things start to swim. Some guy says to Frank, "Another brew, Frankie?" Then this student says, "I have some anti-pollution songs I wrote. Would you like to see them?" Zappa says, "Yeah, sure, sometime." And then there's some guy singing, "Come sit by my side, come, come, dumb changes." Then they show a photograph of a motorbike. So some guy says to one of the mothers, "Some chopper, eh?" And then the mother says, "I was looking at the motorcycle, actually." So there's a beautiful girl on the bike. The guy is saying, "Some chopper." The mother invention pretends that chopper refers to the girl. Then another woman, older woman, asks the mother, "What's your sign?" And the mother invention says, "I don't have one." Then someone says to Frank, "Where do you guys buy your clothes? Have you ever met the Beach Boys?" Another guy asks the mother, "Is there more action in New York or out on the coast?" Another guy asks the mother, "Is wrestling fixed?" Someone else says, "Dean Martin doesn't really drink that much, does he? Is Bobby Dylan really Jewish? Are those real cigarettes or you know what?" I guess he means marijuana. Then some older guy, or just one committee member or teacher, says, "I better go, Rick. I have a lab in the morning." The committee chief says, "That's okay. I'll drive them home later on." So then it says, later on, one of the mothers is reading a horror comics book. Somebody is puking in the bathroom, and these, I don't know if they're adults or whatever, says, looks like Rick has passed out, ha, ha, ha. The other guy says, ha, 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 is the taxi still running this time of night? Then, it says, 3 hours later, the mothers are in bed, or somebody's in bed. I guess that's Zappa. And he's saying, "Hi. Did you get, somebody's calling him. Hi, did you get some sleep? Let me see, it's 6 o'clock now." We'll be over to pick you up at 10:30 sharp. And then someone's dreaming something. Then at the airport coffee shop, how did you get the idea for the act? They're asking Frank. Who writes most of your songs? What's the difference between an agent and a manager? Are you still at school, or do you do this full time? And then somebody says, I'm thinking of organizing a big rock festival here, Frankie. Just top names. I know all the DJs in the area. Another guy says to Frank, I may be going east for Thanksgiving. Let's get together. Where do you live in New York? Zappa says, Laurel Canyon. So now the mothers are getting on the plane. And one of the mothers is singing, Adios, muchachos. That'd be the Mexican of the group. So one of the students says, where are you off to now? And the mother says, we're moving on to Centerville. Now, Centerville is the town in the movie 200 Motels, the fake all-American town. And somebody's running on to the tarmac with paper flying out of his hand saying, my songs! I guess he wants to give Frank his songs. Then somebody asked one of the mothers asked the stewardess, do you have Fortune magazine? Then the kids are driving home through the away from the airport, and they say, Frank wants to help me organize my rock festival, but keep it under your hats, though. And another person says, boy, what a bunch of weirdos. Then someone else says, for the same price, we could have had the Brothers Four. So, what do you make of that? It's not very funny, eh?
Well,
no,
it's interesting. Many thanks for...
No. It'll have to pass for humor, I guess.
I guess they're showing how dull it is for Zappa to go to these high school or this young audience, which is a bunch of corny people out there in middle America. Corny kids, square kids. He has to listen to them. He only says one thing. They ask him, what do you think of the government? He says, I think they're trying to take over the country. That's the government bureaucracy? Is he predicting Dr. Beter's Bolsheviks?
If you look, too, the way they draw everyone else's eyes, they're just these blank dots. And then Zappa's got, like, a fully realistic drawn eye and these furrowed brows, and he looks like a Crumb character drawn into this Archie comic.
Right.
Robert
Crumb. Everybody's all excited, wide-eyed teenagers. Zappa has personality moods in his face.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they're just, they all have these blank expressions, yep.
The students. Or is
students
that? The students have the blank.
Everybody but the mothers have these dots for eyes and these sort of blank expressions, blank surprised expressions.
Yeah. Okay, so have we come up with any more inspiration? Shall I start to play my private reading? What do you think?
Yeah, I think
is it a good one?
Reading will be nice.
Yes, we've had enough of Frank.
Well, not really, but I'm very curious because you mentioned that, like, Friday. I really want to listen to that.
Yes, you want to hear what we learned. Okay.
Because he always says, oh, I had a very great session with Adrian, but I cannot tell you that. You have to wait. I cannot tell you what he said. You have to wait.